Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is February the 7th, and we are in Parshas Pinchas. We are on page 884. Last time we finished with the counting of the Jewish people, and also we talked about giving out the land in Eretz Yisrael using a gorol, using a lottery. We talked about the various rules of that. And now we have the counting of the Levim, which were not yet counted. They're counted separately, just as they were back in Parshas Bamidbar. They were counted separately. So too here in Parshas Pinchas, they are being counted separately. So we begin again, page 884. Pasuk Nun Zion, verse 57. Ve'elef hikudei ha'levi l'mishpechosam, and these are the counting of the Levim according to their families. When we did the whole B'nai Yisrael, we didn't read every pasuk, but in this case we will because it's not that long, so we'll go through the whole thing. So these are the families of the Levim. L'gershon mishpachas ha-gershuni, l'kahas mishpachas ha-kehasi, l'imrari mishpachas ha-mirari. Levi had three sons. So Gershon for the Gershuni family, Kahas, the Kahasi family, and Merari, the Merari family. Elam Mishpachos Levi, the following are the families of the Levim, meaning these three sons then broke up into more families as they had children, and some of them grew into big families. Mishpachas HaLivni, Mishpachas HaChevroni, Mishpachas HaMachli, Mishpachas HaMushi, Mishpachas HaKarchi. So that's five families are listed here. Ukahas, Holid es Amram. And Kahas, the second son of Levi, his son was Amram. There are families of Levim that are not listed here that were listed back in Parshas Bamidbar. So just as we mentioned with the B'nai Yisrael that there are some families missing, and we talked about how there had been a civil war because the Jews tried to run back to Mitzrayim, and the Levim chased after them, and there was an internal war, and certain families were completely decimated during that war. Some Levim families were also decimated during that war. And therefore, there are some Levim families that are mentioned in Bamidbar that are not mentioned here. And the Torah now this is kind of a digression because we're talking about general counting, but now we're going to specifically talk about Amram's family. As we know, Amram's family is Moshe and Aaron. V'shem Esh, Pasuk Nuntes, verse 59. V'shem Esh es Amram, in the name of the wife of Amram, Yocheved Bas Levi, was Yocheved, the daughter of Levi. Again, we talked about this back when we were first introduced to Amram and Yocheved in Parshas Shmos, but we'll reiterate it here. Yocheved is the daughter of Levi, Amram is the grandson of Levi. Amram is Kahas's son. Yocheved's brother Kahas, his son is Amram. So Amram is married to his aunt. Amram is the nephew, Yocheved is the aunt. That is a prohibited marriage after the Torah is given. Before the Torah was given, that was a permitted marriage. For non-Jews, that is a permitted marriage. For us, that is a prohibited marriage. So since Amram and Yocheved had been married before, and by the time the Torah was given, they were no longer married to each other, or they were no longer alive. Either way, it wasn't relevant anymore to them. But but at the time that they were married and that they had Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam, their marriage was permitted because the Torah had not yet been given. So the name of the wife of Amram was Yocheved, the daughter of Levi, Asher Yalda Osa LeLevi B'Mitzrayim, that she, meaning the wife of the wife of Levi, gave birth to her in Mitzrayim. Now we know that she wasn't actually born in Mitzrayim, or she was sort of born in Mitzrayim. She's the 70th of the 70 souls counted back in Parshas Vayigash. There are 69 listed, but we know there's a 70th, and the 70th is Yocheved. And the way it says it in the Gemara is that she was Nolda Bein HaChomos. She was born between the walls. The imagery is they crossed the threshold into Egypt, crossing through the walls, and she was born like right there on the road. So that's not necessarily the case. It doesn't have to be that dramatic. The point is that they came into Egypt and immediately she was born. The very first thing that happened when they got to Egypt was she was born. So therefore she's considered to be one of the 70 souls that came to Egypt because she was essentially born right when they got there, so she's considered to be one of the ones that came along with the 69. Rather than she's not considered to be the first one born in Egypt, she's considered to be the last one born as they were coming down to Egypt. Because they hadn't settled down yet, they were still basically settling in when she was born. Vatevel la'amram es Aaron ves Moshe ve'es Miriam achosam. So, she gave birth for Amram. They had three children, Aaron, Moshe, and Miriam, their sister. Pasuk Salach, verse 60. Vayivalei v'Aaron es Nadav ve'es Avihu es Elazar ve'es Isamar. We know that Aaron had four sons, Nadav, Avihu, Elazar, and Isamar. And, tragically, vayamas Nadav v'Avihu ba'akrivam esh zara lifnei Hashem. Nadav and Avihu died when they brought a foreign fire before Hashem back in Parshas Shmini. So what is the final count of the Levim? Vayu fukudehem, and their numbers were Shlosha ve'esrim elef, 23,000, kol zachar mi ben chodesh v'mala, that's all the males from 1 month and up. Kilo haspaktu besoch b'nei Yisrael, for they were not counted among the Jewish people. Kilo nitan lahem nachala besoch b'nei Yisrael, because they were not given any inheritance among the Jewish people. The first count, the one that included the Jews, but not the Levim, was the count of who would get land in Israel. So those 601,730, those are the ones that got land. Levi didn't get land. They got cities, but they didn't get land. So therefore, they're not included in that count, and instead, they're counted separately, and there are 23,000. It is noteworthy and really surprising that we talked about how the count of the Jewish people was very similar to the first count 40 years earlier. The count at the beginning of the 40 years was 603,550, and at the end of the 40 years it was 601,730. Very, very close. Less than 2,000 apart. A very, 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 very similar count. The Levim is even more similar. It's the same number. It was 23,000 last time, it's 23,000 this time. Now the truth is, it wasn't really 23,000 last time. It was really 23,273. But the Torah last time said it was 23,000. How's it go? 1 second. It says 23,000. Let me get this right. The Torah says it was 23,000. And let's look at it together. Let's hold the place here at 884. Let's turn back to Bamidbar. Rather than my attempting to recite it and getting it wrong, let's read it inside. What's that? Yes, on page 742. Yeah, I'm sorry. It's not exact. There it was. At the 742. Yeah, 22,000. The end of Pasuk Lamed Tes, end of 39, the number was 22,000. Here the number is 23,000. So it's very close. But it wasn't really 22,000. It was 22,000. There was another 273.
Well, that's the next.
Yeah, that's the right. That the firstborn were right. Okay, so let's take a step back. It really was 23,000. I'm sorry. Let's do it this way. I'm really making it very, very clear over here. If we go back a little bit Turn back to the previous page, please, page 740. So we'll see over there, as it counts the three branches of the Levium, Gershon, Kahas, and Merari. So Gershon, in Pesach Chaf Beis, verse 22, Gershon was 7,500. That's what it says in Pesach Chaf Beis 22. He was 7,500. Kahas, it tells us in Pasuk Lamed Dalet 34. Oh no, I skipped ahead, sorry. 8,600. What Pasuk is that?
28,
thank you. Chafres 28, 8,600. And then in 34, Lamed Dalet, it tells us that Merari was 6,200. So 7,500, 8,600, and 6,200, if you add that up together, you get 22,300. That's what you get. 22,300. Right. But in the end, it only says there were 22,000. So it drops 300 off the count at the end. And the Bechoros were 22,273. So the Gemara asks, why did it drop the 300 off of the Levium? It says 22,000 instead of 22,300. And we talked about this back in Parshas Bamidbar. The reason why it dropped those off is because those 300 Levium were also Bechoros. And we're trying to count the Levium who were Levium and not firstborn, because they're going to exchange for the firstborn Jews, for the firstborn non-Levium. So we can't count the firstborn Levium, because they exchange for themselves. They're already firstborn, and every Levi was exchanged for a firstborn. So therefore, even though they really equal 22,300, but it only says 22,000. Here in Parshas Pinchas, it was 23,000. So this is similar to what we find with the rest of the Jewish people, that the number is very close. Even though it's 40 years later, and you expect that there should be at least some increase across the board. And as we talked about, the reason why the Jews did not increase is because there were plagues and there were death and there were different things that caused people to not, the Jews did not become a much larger nation over the 40 years in the wilderness. They didn't diminish, but they did not grow. And that was across the board. We pointed out that with the different tribes, there were some that went up and some went down. And there were a few that may had dramatic changes, but most remained essentially in the same ballpark. And that's what you find with the Levium as well. Last time they were 22,300, and here they're 23,000. Not much of a change for the Levium. Pasuk, back on page 884. Pasuk, Samach Gimel, 63. Eile Pigudei Moshe ve'Elazar HaKohen. These that we just counted is the counting of Moshe and Elazar the Kohen. Elazar is now the Kohen Gadol because Aaron is no longer alive. So Moshe and Elazar, they're the ones who did this counting. Asher Pakdu es Bnei Yisrael Barvos Moav. They counted the Jews on the plains of Moav. Al Yarden Yerecho, on right adjacent to the Yarden, the Jordan River, across from Yericho. And in this group, there was no man from the counting of Moshe and Aaron HaKohen. Asher paktu es b'nei Yisrael b'midbar Sinai, that they counted the Jewish people in the wilderness of Sinai. So there's no man left from that count. Ki amar Hashem lahem, because Hashem said regarding them, Mos yamusu b'midbar, they shall die in the wilderness. No man remained from them, with the exception of Kalev and Yehoshua, the two spies who gave a positive report. They are the only ones to remain from that group. Now, you could ask, Moshe remains from that group. I mean, he was there. But, first of all, he was not part of the count of all the Jews. He was a Levi. So it wasn't part of all the Jews. And we know he's going to die before they enter Eretz Yisrael. So he may be alive now, but he's not going to go in. However, there is a discussion when it says that all of the Jews who were counted the first time died out, and now it's a new group, does that mean, we know that they counted from age 20 and up. Did they only count until 60 years old? Or what about those who were over 60? There are opinions that say, it's a machlokas, it's a difference of opinion. There are opinions that say that those who were over 60 at the beginning of the 40 years could still be alive now at the end of the 40 years. Meaning, obviously, they would be very advanced in age, so they may have died from old age. But they weren't necessarily included in the decree that generation needed to die out in the wilderness. Some say it's 20 and up, some say it's 20 to 60. So those who were over 60 at the time of the spies and the golden calf, they may have still been alive at this time. So according to that opinion, Moshe would have been exempt anyway, because Moshe was over 60, he was 80 years old at the time of the golden calf and the spies, so he would have been exempt anyway from the entire decree, and also he may have been exempt because he wasn't involved in the sins at all. But either way, the certainly the bulk of the Jewish people had died out. But not really. Not really.
The under 20.
Well, the under 20s were alive, and plus, it says very specifically, V'lo nosar mehem ish. There was no leftover man. The women were not included in the decree. The women, they may have died of old age, but they were not included in the decree, which is going to lead us to the next discussion of the daughters of Tzlochat. Yes?
Was Elazar?
Elazar. Yeah, so we don't know how old he was. We don't know his age. You would think he was older because Aaron was 83 when we left Mitzrayim.
So he would have been in that group then.
Right. That's a good question. So either, the Levium would not have been included.
Oh, right.
The Levium would not have been included. Right. Okay. Right. Yeah. Okay.
Rabbi?
Yes?
When we say that we would have thought that the Jewish people would have grown, how do we know the women's part of the population?
Yeah, no, they may have, the women may have grown. This is only counting this is only counting the men over 20 years old who are eligible to get land in Israel, which is again why we're going to move into the daughters of Tzlochat next. And also the men who are part of the army. That's what's being counted over here. But right, we have no idea, how many women there were, and likely there were a lot more women.
And what about the Erev Rav? Are they all gone? Because they wouldn't be in the count either.
Right, they shouldn't be in the count. Any ger should not be in the count. Any convert should not be in the count. From all the stories in the Chumash, I always assumed that they must have been wiped out. But there is a Rashi that says there were still some Erev Rav when we entered Eretz Yisrael. So I don't know how, it's hard to know how many were there in the first place. And then what happened, certainly many of them died, but it seems like there may have been a few that made it all the way through.
Didn't Yitro's group, family, they got a portion?
Yeah, Yitro's group, right. They got a portion as well. That's right. They were the only Gerim to get a portion of Eretz Yisrael. Right. Okay, so now that we have brought up that the men are the ones who died out, but the women did not. So that leads to this next discussion on page 886, the beginning of Perek Chav Zayin, beginning of chapter 27, the famous Benos Tzlochat, the daughters of Tzlochat. Vatikravna Benos Tzlochat, Ben Chefer, Ben Gilad, Ben Machir, Ben Menashe. The daughters of Tzlochat, who was the son of Chefer, who was the son of Gilad, who was the son of Machir, who was the son of Menashe, Lemishpachos Menashe ben Yosef, from the families of Menashe, the son of Yosef. So, let's count it out. You've got Yosef, his son Menashe, his grandson Machir, his great-grandson Gilad, his great-great-grandson Chefer, his great-great-great-grandson Tzlochat, and then his great-great-great-great-granddaughters, the daughters of Tzlochat, which we'll name in a moment. So that's who we're talking about. The Gemara tells us that when you have a tzaddik or a tzaddikus, and the Torah or the Navi lists that person's lineage, the message is they were all tzaddikim. If you have a Rasha and that person is listed with all of his lineage, then the message is they were all Rashaim. As the Torah is saying, the daughters of Tzolofchad were related to Tzolofchad, to Hefer, to Gilad, to Machir, to Menashe, to Yosef. They come all the way from there. In other words, the righteousness of Yosef filters all the way down to this generation of the daughters of Tzolofchad. Another way to say it is that whenever you have great and righteous people, everybody wants to claim a connection to them. Who wouldn't want to claim a connection to a great person? You always want to say, oh yeah, you know, we were buddies in high school, right? You want to have some way of connecting to the great people. So everybody wants to be connected to the daughters of Tzolofchad. So we don't stop by saying the daughters of Tzolofchad. The daughters of Tzolofchad, the son of Hefer, the son of Gilad, the son of Machir, the son of Menashe, who comes from Yosef. And everybody wants to have the zechus, the merit of being connected to the daughters of Tzolofchad. The Eilish Shmos ben Osav, and these are the names of his daughters, of Tzolofchad's daughters, Machla, Noah, V'chagla, Umilka, V'sirtza. So it's five daughters, Machla, Noah, Chagla, Milka, and Tirtza. Those are the five daughters. It's interesting how those names, not all of them are popular names that people use when they name children today. It's interesting. I mean, why certain names become popular and certain names don't, I don't know. But these are not the most common names. Noah is interesting because people think that Noah is Noach, because in English you say Noah, but really Noah is a girl's name. Noah, without the ch sound, is really a girl's name, and it is one of the daughters of Tzolofchad. As we will see, although we will not see it tonight, it's going to take some time till we get to it, but Noah was wise beyond her years. It's interesting, we lump the five of them together, but we do know something about Noah, that she was wise beyond her years, as we will see, hopefully, but it will take a little while till we get there.
But Tirzah and Noah are more common in Israel than they are here.
Yeah, yeah. I have a cousin named Noah. But yeah, there's, right, it's true.
When you said about the connection of the names, does that mean that Tzolofchad wasn't as bad as we might have thought?
Right, correct. Tzolofchad was really a tzaddik who did something wrong. We find that, you know, people are not perfect, and he did something that was actually very bad, but he was ultimately a righteous person. Right. Now, the Gemara tells us that the another reason why we date them all the way back, we trace them all the way back to Yosef, is because the daughters of Tzolofchad loved Eretz Yisrael. That's, they're going to say that they should get a portion of the land of Israel. They weren't coming because they wanted the material wealth of having land in Eretz Yisrael, because that was wealth. If you didn't have land, it was very difficult to be a wealthy person. It did mean having some financial standing. It also meant having some stability to have land. That's not what they were coming for. They were coming because they were mechabev es haaretz. They cherished the land. And that's why, one of the reasons why, we trace them all the way back to Yosef. Because Yosef is the one who says that you should take my bones with you to Eretz Yisrael. He cherished the land of Eretz Yisrael. So just as Yosef cherishes the land, the daughters of Tzolofchad cherish the land. There's a connection between the two. And they come from Yosef. They're in the tribe of Menashe, which comes, of course, from Yosef.
Why wouldn't they go all the way back to
Yaakov? Yeah, we all
also asked to be buried.
Right, that's true. That's true. But we all go back to Yaakov. I guess we're just trying to show the one. Okay, it's a good question.
You mentioned Menashe twice. It said Menashe, and it's saying the Menashe of Yosef.
Right, right.
And they had it like, why did they have to?
Why do it that way? Just say
they clarified it.
Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah, I don't have a very good answer for that, except to say that, since Menashe is himself a tribe, so when you get back to Menashe, you've already gotten to something, and then we're going to add Menashe is from Yosef in order to get Yosef into the mix also. But we've really gotten to the parent tribe when you get to Menashe. But still, the question is better than the answer. Pasuk Beis, verse 2. So what do these women do? Vata modna, they came close, but what did they do? Vata modna lifnei Moshe, v'lifnei Elazar ha-Kohen. They stood before Moshe, before Elazar the Kohen, v'lifnei ha-Nesiim, and in front of the leaders, v'chol ha-Eda, and all the congregation, Pesach ohel moed, in front of the Mishkan, lemor, saying. This verse seems very simple, but the Gemara has a problem with it, which answers in two ways. The problem is that the way that it says it sounds like they went to Moshe, and then they went to Elazar, and then they went to the Nisim, and then they went to everybody else. So the Gemara says, I don't understand. If you went to Moshe and Moshe didn't know, then how would Elazar know? How would the Nisim know? What does it mean? How can you go from one to the other? If you already went to the top. So there are two answers the Gemara gives. One answer is that the Gemara is saying it in the reverse order. Really, they went to the Eda, to the congregation, which means to the general sages first. They didn't know. So they went to the Nesiim, the leadership. They didn't know. They went to Elazar. He didn't know. So they went to Moshe. As they went up the ladder, as they went. But the Torah lists them in the order of their importance, and therefore it puts Moshe first. But really, the order that they spoke to these people was in the reverse order. That's one answer. The other answer is, they came to the Beis Medrash. All these people were studying Torah in the Beis Medrash. And they came to the Beis Medrash and addressed everybody simultaneously. Even, of course, Moshe is the main one they're talking to. He's the head. But their question, their shaila, was posed to everybody. It was posed in front of everybody. No one is going to speak up in front of Moshe Rabbeinu. He's there, so he's going to be the one to talk. But the question was posed in front of all of them. And so what did they say? And the Torah says lemor, which means the Torah is going to give us the specific points they made. We're not paraphrasing here. We're saying this is what they said. Pasuk Gimel, verse 3. Avinu meis bamidbar. Our father died in the wilderness. V'hu lo haya b'sach ha'eda hano adim al Hashem. They were not among the congregation that was complaining against Hashem. Ba'adas Korach. And they also were not among the group of Korach. They weren't among those types of people. Ki vechet o meis. He died of his own sin. Uvanim lo hayu lo, and he had no sons. Let's stop and think about this for a moment. Daughters come and they say, our father died. He wasn't part of the complainers. He wasn't part of Korach. He died of his own sin. That's a pretty strong way to say it. Right? He died. He wasn't among Korach's group. He wasn't among the complainers. He died. But to say he died of his own sin. It's pretty harsh to say that. He died of his own sin. Why couldn't they just say he died? So it must be, therefore, he died doing something that we all know was a sin, and he was punished by being killed. Otherwise, there's no reason for them to say that. How do you know? You don't know why somebody dies. None of us know why somebody dies. But nobody knows. Nobody knows if it's the person's time. Nobody knows if the person did a sin. Nobody has any idea. How can they say he died because of his own sin? So it must be that he did do a sin for which he was killed. And everybody, all of us, know that. We don't know which sin he did, but we all are familiar with the sin that was committed. And we just don't know the name of the person or people involved, and they're saying our father did it. And that's why they have to preface their remarks by saying he did not die because of being part of Korach's group. And he did not die because of being among the complainers. So then what did he do? What sin was committed in the wilderness that was not part of the complainers and not part of Korach, but nevertheless, whoever did it was killed? Now that question has to also, the answer to that question, has to also presume that for whatever reason he was killed, even though he was killed for a sin, it wasn't as bad as Korach, and it wasn't as bad as the complainers. You have to say that, otherwise, what's the point they're trying to make? They're trying to make a point over here. Yes, he did a sin, and yes, he was killed, but he wasn't part of those groups. That means those groups are worse, and whatever he did was not as bad. So what is it that he did that was still, he still died for it, but it wasn't as bad as Korach and the others? And why isn't it as bad? So what Chazal tell us is that what they were saying is, Korach was a choti umachti es harabim. Korach sinned and he drew others with him into his sin. He was not a lone operator. He brought others in. He got others to sin with him. A lot of times the complainers throughout the story of the Chumash, they drew others in as they complained. They didn't want to be the only ones. And they pulled others in. If you have a large group, you feel more secure. They were saying, yes, our father did a sin, and yes, he died, but it was his own sin. He did not draw others with him. So that limits it. So what could he have done that he did not draw others in with him, yet he was killed for it? So that's why there are two opinions, and only two opinions, of what he did. One answer is that he was of the Mapilim. He was of that group of people that after Hashem said, after the spies, you can't go into Eretz Yisrael. And this group, they said to Moshe Rabbeinu the next day, we sinned, we were wrong, now we're going in. And Moshe said, don't go, Hashem is not with you. And they went anyway, and they were killed. So they didn't draw others with them. They didn't go round into Klal Yisrael and say, come with us, come with us, come with us, come with us. They didn't do that. They said, we know we sinned, and we admit our sin, and now we're going to go in, because now we feel that we've done teshuva, and we're going to go in. So they were wrong, and they were killed for being wrong, because Moshe Rabbeinu said not to go. But that sin is not as bad as what Korach did, or what the complainers did, because they weren't trying to rope others in with them. And more than that, they weren't rebellious. They weren't saying, we're going against Hashem, or anything like that. Or even we're going against Moshe Rabbeinu. They weren't even saying that. They were saying, we want to go into Eretz Yisrael. It only magnifies their love for Eretz Yisrael. It was a misplaced love in that case. They were not supposed to go. Make no mistake, we can't make them into righteous people for what they did. They did a sin. We can't make it into a mitzvah. They did a sin, an avera, they were killed for it. But I think all of us can have a little bit of, we can forgive that sin a little bit better than we can forgive Korach's sin. So that's one suggestion. The other suggestion is that he was the Mekoshesh Eitzim. He's the one who was found on Shabbos either gathering wood or detaching the wood from the ground, that he was doing a sin of being Mechalal Shabbos, that he was desecrating Shabbos, for which he was put to death for that. That was also a one-person sin. It was not something that was done together with other people. And even though it was wrong, and he did have a reason for doing it, the reason, again, was misplaced. He should not have done it. But he had his reason for doing it, which we discussed back then in Parshas Shlach. And he was killed for it, but he was not like Korach or the others, that he roped others into his sin. So they're saying, our father did do a sin, he was killed, but he was not like those other ones. And why are they saying that? Because they're trying to say, he didn't deserve to lose his portion in Eretz Yisrael. Korach deserved to lose his portion in Eretz Yisrael. Korach was saying, I'm not part of the establishment of the Jewish people. That's what he was doing. He was setting himself apart. So we can understand that he would lose his portion. The other spies, besides Yehoshua and Kalev, they lost their portion in Eretz Yisrael. Because they were saying, we don't want Eretz Yisrael. So they didn't get Eretz Yisrael. But Salafcha did not do anything for which he would forfeit his right to Eretz Yisrael. He forfeited his life, but he did not forfeit his right to the land. And that's the point they're trying to make. But he didn't have any sons. So now what? Pasuk Dalet, verse 4. Lama yigarashem avinu mitoch mishpachto. Why should our father's name be diminished or removed from within his family? Ki ein lo bein, for he has no son. Tenalanu achuza besoch achei avinu. Give us a portion amongst the brothers of our father. Vayakrev Moshe es mishpatan lifnei Hashem. Moshe brought their judgment before Hashem. The Gemara tells us that the parsha of Nachala, that the laws of inheritance should have been taught by Moshe Rabbeinu without any drama. Like every other law in the Torah. Whatever laws, all the laws in the Torah, Moshe just said them. So it should have been, Vayidaber Hashem al Moshe Lamar, Hashem spoke to Moshe saying, and here are the rules of inheritance. And he should have just said them to us. It didn't need to have drama. Why does it have drama that Moshe doesn't know, and the Bnei Salaf will come and ask, and then he has to go take their question to Hashem? And the Gemara tells us the reason why Hashem did it this way was because of the merit of the daughters of Salafchad, because they were righteous, and therefore they deserved that there should be a paragraph of the Torah that is taught through them, that they trigger this paragraph of the Torah. And therefore Hashem caused that Moshe Rabbeinu would not know the law so that it would come about through the daughters of Tzalafchad. Moreover, this is one of the four places in the Chumash where Moshe Rabbeinu goes to Hashem and is answered immediately. He goes to Hashem of his own volition. It's not Hashem coming to him. He goes to Hashem and he says, here's the question, and Hashem gives him the answer. Moshe Rabbeinu had that direct line to Hashem. He didn't use it all the time. He didn't need to use it all the time. But this is one of those cases where he goes before Hashem. He says, this is the question. I don't know the answer. And Hashem says, okay, here's the answer. Tell it to the Jewish people. And from here, this is where all the laws of Nachala, all the laws of inheritance of the Jewish people, of Halacha, comes from this next paragraph. Now, as with all mitzvahs of the Torah, you've got what it says in the Psukim, and then you have the Torah Sheba'al Peh. You have the oral Torah that complements it and fills it in. So this is only going to be a few Psukim. It's not going to cover every single case. But from here, the Gemara extrapolates out and covers all the different cases of inheritance. So we will fill in whatever we can fill in, whatever we know, and whatever we're able to fill in the time that we have, we'll fill some of that in over here. But there is a word about inheritance before we do that. Yes?
The word mishpachton here, it says huge nun.
Yes.
Is that the way it is everywhere?
Yes. Yeah, in the Chumash itself, in the Torah itself, there's a big nun. I don't know the reason. I always assume it has to do with their righteousness, but I don't know specifically why the nun. But it is in the Torah itself, there's a big nun over there. Yeah. Now, the laws of inheritance that we're about to read apply today. They apply because the laws of inheritance are they are inherent, which means that you can't change them. They are. When a person dies and they have assets, then this is what happens. It's an automatic transfer. It's not dependent on a will. It's not dependent on a government. It is an automatic transfer that the Torah says. So just let's take it very simply. A man dies. He has a son and no other children. Automatically, without any advance directive, without any government intervention, without any attorneys, without anything, automatically, everything he owns is now owned by his son. And it's immediate. It happens at the moment of death. Right away, everything he owns is now owned by his son. That is the way it works in the Torah, and we'll see that what if there's no son, no daughter, etc., and we're going to have a different pecking order of how it works. But inheritance is immediate. That's why when we want to write a will, that's why wills have a halacha consideration. Because any time a person writes a will, what they're trying to do is somehow sidestep what it says in the Torah. You can't you can't go above what it says in the Torah. This is what happens. You can't get around that. It, just as sure as when Friday night hits and you get sun, the sun goes down, Shabbos begins, you can't stop that. When a man dies, his assets go to his son immediately. There's nothing you can do about that. So that's why having a will is a tricky thing. How does that work? How will a will get around what it says straight, black on white, in the Torah? So that's why it's a tricky thing. Obviously, it does work, but we have to understand why it works. So first, we're going to read this paragraph and see what the pecking order is, how it works, and then we'll have to discuss how we get around that with a will, and whether we should get around it with a will, and when we should get around it. Pasuk Vav, verse 6. Vayomra Hashem Moshe, Lemar Hashem said to Moshe, saying, Kain benos Tzalafchad dovros, what the daughters of Tzalafchad are speaking is correct. The Gemara says, Ashrei, fortunate is the one that Hashem gives them a stamp of approval for what they said. They are correct. Nason titain lahem achuzas nachala b'socha chayavihem. You should surely give them an inheritance amongst the brothers of their father, v'ha'avarta es nachalas avihen lahen. And you should pass the inheritance of their father to them. They not only got their father's inheritance, but they also got their father's portion of their grandfather's inheritance, because Tzalafchad left Egypt. He was one of the ones who left Egypt. And so did his father, Chefer. Chefer also left Egypt. Therefore, Chefer and Tzalafchad both had land in Israel. So Tzalafchad's land went to his daughters, and Chefer's land was divided amongst Tzalafchad's brothers and his daughters. His daughters took his place, and they acted as one of the brothers in the inheritance from their grandfather, from Chefer. So they actually ended up with a lot of land in Eretz Yisrael, even though it was five of them, but they ended up with a large portion. Pasuk Ches, verse 8. Ve'al b'nei Yisrael tadaber le'mor, and to the Jews you should speak as follows. Ish ki yamus, a man who should die, uvein ein lo, and he has no son, v'havar temes nachalaso levito. Then you pass the inheritance to his daughter. V'imein lo bas, if he has no daughter, so he has no sons or daughters, unis natemes nachalaso le'echav. Then the inheritance goes to his brothers. V'imein lo achim, if he has no brothers, unis natemes nachalaso le'achei aviv. Then it goes to his father's brothers. V'imein achim le'aviv, if he has no brothers for his father, so he has no sons, he has no daughters, he has no brothers, he has no uncles, then what? Unisatemes nachalaso, you shall give his inheritance, lish ero hakarov a love, to his relative that is closest to him. Mimishpachto, from his family, viarash osa, and he will inherit it. The closest relative. Well, who's that? Didn't tell us who that is, just said the closest relative. So what's that supposed to mean? Vayisal livnei Yisrael l'chukas mishpat, and this will be for the Jewish people as a statute of law, kasher tziva Hashem es Moshe, like Hashem commanded Moshe. So the Torah only says the first four in the order: sons, daughters, brothers, uncles, and then closest relative. So who's that? Didn't tell us.
Does it say closest male, or could it be closest female?
Also, good question.
I keep wondering about his wife. Does
and what about wife? Good question. Okay. So, the Gemara in Maseches Bava Basra explains that the Torah is giving us a general guideline, which is meant to, there's a lot to fill in the blanks over here, which is meant to teach a very specific pecking order. And it works, it's actually not so complicated, but you have to know the system. And the system is called, in the language of the Gemara, it's an interesting word, mishmush. That's the word of the Gemara, mishmush. Okay. That's the word. So, how does it work? So, the easy part is that it goes to his children. First, sons. If there are no sons, then daughters. If there are sons and daughters, only the sons get, not the daughters. That's why the daughters of Tzelophehad came, only because there were no brothers. If there were brothers, they would not have come, because they would have they knew that the boys get. So if there are sons, it goes to the sons. If there are no sons, it goes to the daughters. But here's the thing, and this is critical to understand the whole system. If there had been sons, and the sons are no longer alive, but their children are alive, they get it. Meaning, children take the place of the generation above them. Which means as follows. Let's say a man has a son and a daughter. Man dies, there's a son and a daughter. There's Reuven and there's Shprinsa. But Reuven's not alive anymore. Reuven has a daughter. Reuven has a daughter, Chani. So there's a granddaughter, Chani. There's a daughter, Shprinsa. Chani gets the entire inheritance, and Shprinsa gets nothing. Because Chani replaces her father. So she is essentially the male. Because she's the male inheritance. She comes from her father. So she gets the whole thing. And Shprinsa is a daughter, so she doesn't get. Similarly, let's say Reuven dies, and a man dies, and he has two sons. Just two sons, Reuven and Shimon. He has Reuven and Shimon. So they split the inheritance. But what if Reuven is no longer alive, but he has a daughter, Shprinsa? So now there's a son, Shimon. There's a granddaughter, Shprinsa. They split it evenly, because Shprinsa replaces her father, Reuven. And therefore, the two of them are equal in the inheritance of their father. So a child, you always move back to the previous generation. They always replace the previous generation. So when it says over here that Tzelophehad died and there were no sons, not only were there no sons, there were no offspring from sons. There was no line that had come from sons. The only line that there was were the five daughters. And that's why they now inherit. If any of them would not have been alive, any of the five daughters of Tzelophehad would not have been alive, then their children would have replaced them. Male or female would have replaced them, and you would have had, it would have been split five ways, but it would have been four daughters and a grandson. They would have split, or a granddaughter. They would have split five ways also. That doesn't matter. So one always comes back to the previous generation. Now the reason why it's important to know is because that's how it's going to inform everything else. So there's no sons, no daughters, no grandsons, no granddaughters, no great-grandchildren, nothing. There's nothing below the person. So where do we go next? So the Torah says you go to the brother. But the truth is that it doesn't work exactly that way. You really go back to the father. You go back to the father. Except that very often, when a man dies, the father has already died. There is no father. If the man died at an old age, then his father is no longer alive. So you're really supposed to go back to his father, but his father is not alive. So then you go to his father's children. Who are his father's children? The deceased's brothers. So that's the way it works. What you keep doing is you keep going back a generation. And if that generation is no longer alive, and usually when you keep going back generations, that generation is no longer going to be alive, then you follow their children down. And if they are if that whole line is not present, is not alive, you go back another generation to the grandfather. And now start working your way down from the grandfather. Well, the sons of the grandfather are going to be his uncles. If they're not alive, you look at his cousins. If they're not alive, his cousins' children. All the way down. If none of them are alive, you're going to go back to his great-grandfather and then start to branch out the children from the great-grandfather. So what happens is that whoever dies, we'll put him right up over here, you look below him first. If there's nothing below him, you go above him to the previous generation and then go down from that one. And if there's nothing amongst any of that, you go back to the previous generation and go down from that one. You keep doing that all the way back to Yaakov Avinu. Now, we wouldn't be able to do that because we don't have the family trees. So we wouldn't be able to trace it like that, all the way back to Yaakov Avinu. But in theory, if we had the family tree of every Jew going all the way back, then we would know where it all goes. And eventually, it would go all the way back to Yaakov Avinu, and or at least to the tribe. assuming all the tribes are still alive, that there's representation from all the tribes, so then you'd eventually hit whoever it is, you know, Shevet Naphtali, and then someone would be alive in Shevet Naphtali who would get it from that person. So that's the way it works across the board. The question then is, we've mentioned this before, in theory we all have land in Eretz Yisrael, because somebody back there had land, and it was handed down, but we're totally lost, we don't know who had what land, and we have no idea. But if it was all laid out before us, and we're able to follow it, we would be able to trace back to whoever had it, and then follow the line down, and there would be land that would belong to us in Eretz Yisrael. So, the answer to the question of daughters is, as we said, it's always the boys first, if not the boys, then the girls. That's always the case. But the question is, what about a wife? For that matter, what about a husband? Neither are mentioned over here. It doesn't talk about if a woman dies. If a woman dies, it's the same thing. Her sons come first, then her daughters. If there are no sons, no daughters, then you go back to her father. If he's not alive, then the same system. But what about spouses? So the halacha is, a husband inherits his wife, a wife does not inherit her husband. Again, a husband inherits a wife. If a wife predeceases her husband gets her assets. If a husband predeceases his wife, a wife does not inherit her husband. So that means that if a wife passes away before her husband, even if she has children, even if she has children from a different marriage, her husband inherits her, not her children. If a man passes away before his wife, then his children will inherit him, irrespective of which wife they come from. They're going to inherit him and not his wife. That's the way it works. The ksuba is going to affect everything. We'll have to explain why, but the ksuba is going to affect the entire way that it works, which we'll talk about in a moment. But that's the way it goes. How do we know that a husband inherits his wife? It's based on one of the verses here. It's a little bit technical and complex, and we don't have a lot of time. So I was going to go through that with you, but I'm going to go gloss over that right now, because I want to make sure we get in the issue of the ksuba and the issue of a will, because those are things that are going to affect these things. So how does the ksuba work? How does the ksuba work? If all the assets go to the sons, but the ksuba says that the wife is supposed to get money. The answer to that is, the ksuba is a lien on the husband's assets. It doesn't matter who ends up with the assets, they have to pay the debt. And the ksuba is a lien, it's a debt. And therefore it makes no difference who gets it, whether it's sons, whether it's uncles, it makes no difference. Wherever that property is going to land, that the ksuba has to be paid. So the ksuba works through being a lien on everything he owns. That's the way the ksuba works. Included in a ksuba, we know that there's money that is designated for a wife in the event of death or divorce. But there's more in a ksuba besides that. For example, there's a clause in the ksuba that says that there's a debt to her children from a previous marriage. Not her children, her daughters from a previous marriage. There is a specific clause in the ksuba that there is a lien on his assets to provide for the daughters of his wife, even if they're from another man, that they should be provided for. What about his own daughters? He has sons and daughters. Let's say the Ben Slavchad would have had brothers. They would have gotten everything. What about them? So the answer there is also that this is not in the ksuba, this is a law in the Gemara that the daughters have to be provided for. The truth is it is in the ksuba, but the daughters have to be provided for. So what happens is that the sons inherit, but they're required now to provide for the wife, ostensibly their mother, and the sisters. They're required to take care of them until the sisters get married. Because once they get married, their husbands are required to provide for them. But until that happens, then they have to provide for their mother and for the sisters. The way it usually worked when the ksuba was done, you know, it, according to the laws of the ksuba, and no wills over that got around at all, the way it normally worked was a typical inheritance, which was not a very wealthy inheritance, just a typical run-of-the-mill inheritance, basically ended up with the daughters, not with the sons. Why? Because the sons officially got everything, but they had to use that money to provide for their mother and their sisters. There wasn't enough money to provide for mother and sisters until all the sisters were married and still have left over for the boys. So typically, when there was a run-of-the-mill inheritance, it would be the females in the family who are provided for, and the males would really end up with nothing or very little. If it was a very wealthy inheritance, then the boys would come out ahead because they would be able to provide for their mother and for the sisters, while they themselves would get whatever was left. And if it was a very, very large inheritance, then there was a lot left. So the system ends up being that the females are provided for, but they can't get wealthy. The males usually end up with nothing, but if there is wealth, they'll end up with the wealth. So that's the way it shook out according to the way the Gemara works it out. But that does not explain wills. Yes?
So you said that it happened instantaneously.
Yeah.
So if a man passes away and he only has Sprinza, but his wife is expecting...
Ah, good question. Okay.
She might have a boy.
Okay, excellent question. The question is, what happens if a man dies and he only has a daughter, but there is a pregnancy... His wife is expecting, and then she has a boy. Yeah, that's a good question. It will go to the boy, but it is a complex reason why. It's a good point. So the wills we have not covered, and it's 8 o'clock. So I don't want to go over time. So Blee Netter next week will lead off with how a will works before we go further in the Chumash. But that'll be our lead off for next week.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class. And if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.